Believe me, my name is Gabe Chavez, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober by God's amazing grace. I want to thank Sharon for that wonderful introduction. She came to me earlier before the meeting started. She says, I'm going to be introducing you. She says, I don't know you, I don't know anything about you. And I says, thank God she can't say anything bad about me. My wife's with me tonight, and she's a member of Al-Anon, and she kindly reminded me, they do that in Al-Anon, you know, to thank you and for the appreciation of this wonderful, wonderful dinner you had tonight. I'm truly amazed we have real silverware and real plates and cups, you know, and tablecloths, candles, can you imagine? This is absolutely wonderful, and I want to thank those that were responsible for that. I know a lot of work goes into that, and I want to thank John for asking me to come up here and for that lovely introduction. I truly do consider this a great honor to be in Salina to help you celebrate your 28th anniversary. It's an honor to be at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially to be asked to share your experience, strength, and hope, and for that I'm grateful. Why I'm really here is what I want to share with you before I get into my story. I shared it not too long ago when I was given my lead in Dayton, and I think it's apropos that I share it with you tonight. What length will you go to help another achieve sobriety, and what length will you go to help yourself achieve sobriety? And that's what this program is all about, being willing to give of yourself. And I was taken back about 8 years ago. I was asked to give a lead at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on Christmas night. And I said, yes, I'd like to do that. You know, the program of AA has brought my family back to us, and Christmas is a very special time in our household. And we were having a wonderful day on Christmas Day, and I didn't want to leave the home and go to that meeting, even though I had to give the lead. And so I waited to the very last minute, and then I went to this meeting, and it was held in a church, and it was in Dayton, Ohio, and it was a place called, a suburb of Dayton, Ohio, called Oakwood. And you go into this church, and it's a long church. You have to go all the way down to the basement to get to the meeting room. Anyway, I drove up to the church just before the meeting was to start, and I didn't see one car in the parking lot. And I'm saying to myself, well, maybe I got the time wrong, or something is not right here. So I worked my way into the church, and I walked down this real dark hallway, and I walked downstairs, and I started going down this other hallway where the meeting is to be held, and I saw a light on, so I knew that there was somebody there. And as I got closer to the room, I saw the man that asked me to give the lead that night standing at the doorway. And I walked up to him, and he says, thank you, Gabe, for coming. And I says, there's nobody here. He said, well, it's Christmas night. Maybe they're home with their families. I said, well, maybe you're right. So we went inside and we were talking. I thought, well, maybe a few will come in just before the meeting starts, like I got there. And at 8:30 when this meeting started, we were the only two there. And I said, well, it doesn't look like anybody's going to come. I guess we can call the meeting off. He says, no, this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to have a meeting. I said, there's just the two of us. He says, it only takes two to have a meeting. And then he said, would you please sit down? And I sat down, and he stood up, and he went to the front of the room. I'm the only one there. And he read the preamble to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he looked at me, and he said, would you like to read How It Works? And I says, well, sure. So I got up, and I read How It Worked, and I sat down, and he read the 12 traditions, and he said, would you like to read the promises? And I says, well, sure. And I got up, and I read the promises, and I sat down, and he says, do we have any announcements from the floor? I'm the only one there. He said, well, there's no announcements from the floor. He says, this is a lead meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I've asked a man to come over here and share his experience, strength, and hope. And he's talking to me. And he gave me a wonderful introduction, and I got up, and he sat down. And for the next hour, I told my story to that man. You know, and after I told my story, I sat down and he stood up and he made some wonderful comments about my story. And the meeting was over with, and he passed the basket, and he said, here. And I gave a buck. He took it. He didn't give a buck. I remember that. And I helped him close the meeting up. We put the coffee away, and we straightened up, and we walked out. And we walked to the driveway together, and then he walked me to my car, and he says, I really want to thank you for coming tonight and sharing your experience, strength, and hope. He says, I needed some positive input in my life today. It's really, really tough for me, and he broke down. You see, his family's in Kansas, and he's here, and he's having a real difficult time, and he's new in sobriety, and he needed somebody to help him that night, and he thanked me for helping him. Now, I didn't know at the time that was what it was all about. But that had a profound effect on me. You know, what length are you willing to go to help another person achieve sobriety? You know, coming from Dayton, Ohio here is not a great amount for me to do. You know, I'm going to give you an example of what it takes to go to any length to help another person. A few years ago, in Seattle, Washington, that happens to be my hometown, they held a Special Olympics. And there were 9 contestants there that were considered to be mentally and physically disabled. And they were all lined up to run the 100-yard dash, these 9 people. And at the gun, they all started out, not exactly in a dash, but with a rally to run the race to the finish. All except one little boy who stumbled and he fell over and he started to cry. Now the other 8 contestants heard the little boy cry and they all turned around. And then one by one, they went back to that little boy who was crying. All of them. And one little girl with Down syndrome bent down and kissed the little boy and said, well, this will make it better. And then they did the most amazing thing. All 9 contestants stood up and they linked arms and they marched together to the finish line. Now, and everybody in the stadium gave him a standing ovation, and the cheering went on for a few minutes, you know. And now, and I know deep down inside all of us, you know, it's not winning that's the most important thing for us. Deep down inside, the most important thing for us in Alcoholics Anonymous is help another win, because in helping somebody else win, we win as a result of that benefit, you know. And sometimes we have to change our course and slow down to help those people, you know. And if you pass this on, you know, maybe we'll open up our hearts and we'll help somebody else open up their hearts. You know, we should learn a lesson from those Special Olympians. You know, some people still call those people retarded. You know, are they? A lot more wisdom than we do sometimes. And that's why I'm here. I'm willing to go to any length to do that today. And sometimes I minimize what I do. And sometimes I overemphasize what I do to sound important for what I'm doing. And it's not that at all. There were people here to help me when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my duty, it's my commencement to do the same thing back for you, if you're willing to allow that to happen in your life the way I was allowed to happen in my life, so that we can get on with our lives. I'm here to tell you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Of course, there's a condition to that, the way I perceive the truth. Yeah. I'm here to share, in effect, to share my life with you and the time that I have to share it. I'm going to share about my birth into this world and my death in this world from alcoholism because of the abuse of alcohol, and my rebirth into the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, because I truly do believe this is a fellowship of rebirth, of being reborn and transformed. I truly do believe this is a fellowship of regeneration, a recreation, you know, of a rejuvenation. I truly do believe this is a fellowship of change, of being made all over again. And how much have I changed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? I came to you people, a poor Mexican, on July 19th, 1985. I stand before you tonight, a rich Spaniard. It changes all of you, you know. I want to go back as far as I can go back and share with you up to this point about, you know, what happened and what it was like and what my life is like today. You know, and I came into this world on November 22nd, 1941 in a little small town called Las Vegas, New Mexico. Not Las Vegas, Nevada, but Las Vegas, New Mexico. There is such a town. And that was a couple of weeks before the start of World War II, and I know there are some of you in this room that are kind of young and don't know anything about World War II. I don't know anything about World War II, but I was born a couple of weeks before World War II and into a Mexican family in a poor section of town. I wasn't born in a hospital. I was born in an adobe home. And if you don't know what an adobe home is, that's a home made out of mostly dirt and straw. The street that I was born on wasn't paved with asphalt. It was a dirt street. The front yard of our home wasn't green with grass. It was a dirt front yard. The floor of our home wasn't made of wood or stone. It was a dirt floor. The walls were bare, the shelves were bare, and most of the times the cupboards were bare. I guess the coin is phrased, I was dirt poor when I came into this world. My father came from a large family, raised during the Depression era. My mother also came from a large family, raised during the Depression era, and they got married young in life. Neither one had very much of an education, no skills whatsoever. And where they were married was a little town called Trinidad, and they moved to a little town called Las Vegas, Nevada, so my dad could get a job, secure a job in the coal mines. That's what he wanted to do in order to take care of his family. When I came to this world, there was already a little baby girl in our family. It was my older sister. So he's 19, she's 17, and they already have a baby 2.5 years old. They have a brand new baby, me. It's 2 weeks before World War II, and my father's working not as a coal miner, but as a delivery boy for a grocery store. Now, my father was a proud, loyal, and patriotic American. He wanted to serve his country, so he wanted to go fight in the war. And a few months later, he joined the United States Navy to go off and fight in the war for his country. Left my mother and my older sister and me to fend for themselves. He didn't have any money, didn't have anything to leave him. He went off to fight the war because he was that type of person at that point in his life. My mother, what she did is she packed us all up and took us back to Colorado, across the border from New Mexico, in a little town called Trinidad. And she sent me to live with my grandparents, which live about 5 miles from this town, in a little town called Madrid. And that's where I grew up when my father was off fighting the war. And when you are raised in a small environment, in a poor environment, with poor people, you don't know you're poor. You know? You're joyous, happy, and free, because my grandparents, as much as I can remember about my small life at that point in my life, was that they loved me, and they nurtured me, and they took care of me. And I cherished that time. The war went pretty fast. Daddy came home. Came home to a surprise. I went home to a surprise. See, before he left, my mother became pregnant again. And while he was gone, another child came into the home. So here this father of ours comes home, and he's a complete stranger to us. I'm living with my grandparents. They sent me to live with the family unit, a stranger that I don't know, my father. My mother and my siblings, who I don't know either because I've been raised by my family, we have a strange connection there, all of us together. And things don't go well. I'm a small boy, and I even know things aren't going well. Time to go to school, of course. Being poor, living in the poor neighborhood, we didn't have a school in our neighborhood, so they had to send us to the other side of town where they had a school. That's where the white people lived. Parents get you excited. If a parent now, and I'm sure when you have a child that goes to school, you're going to get them excited so they won't be fearful to go to school, to go out of their environment, to experience something new, because we've never experienced anything in our life except where we lived. And they got me all excited to go to school. Being poor, we didn't have what the poor people had, or the rich people had. Clothes that I had were given to us, were hand-me-downs, were second-hand, were given to us. They were clean clothes, I remember that. We were clean people. We had food on the table. Not much, but we had it. I remember old coveralls that are in fashion today, the ones with the metal buttons on, you know, and they wear them now with one flap undone, but being cool, of course. We weren't cool back then. They had worn out knees. They had. My mother used to get those patches that were material patches that had glue on them. She had to put them on the material of the pants, and she had to iron them on. If the iron wasn't hot enough, it didn't adhere to the pants, and they kind of rolled up on the edges. I remember those things. Her shoes weren't new. I never had a new pair of shoes in my life till I was older in life. Most times they were all scuffed up. Sometimes they were so scuffed you couldn't tell what color they were. That shoelaces at all, they were all tied in knots. And sometimes my shoes were so raggedy that the sole would come loose from the body of the shoe, and when I walked, it made a flapping sound. That's how I went to school. And I was happy, and I was joyous, and I was free. And when I went to school, my very first day of school, my life changed, and I didn't know my life changed. I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 43, and when I had to take a fearless and searching and fearless moral inventory of my life and go back through my life, I went back to the first grade. At the age of 43, I remember what happened to me in the first grade that changed my life. This is what happened to me when I went to grade school, very first day of school. I knew I was different just by the way the children treated us. We didn't dress like them, we didn't eat like them, we didn't talk like them. Called us names like wetback and spick and beaner. I didn't know what those words meant, but I knew they were hurtful just by the way they said them. I was punched, I was hit, I was kicked, I was knocked down my very first day at school. And the most humiliating thing that ever happened to me at that time in my life is another child spit on me. And I remember that today as if it was yesterday, and it was hurtful. And something happened to me. And I didn't know what happened to me. And what happened to me is I withdrew inside of me. What I didn't do is I didn't go to my teacher and say, why are they treating us this way? I didn't go to my mother and my father and say, why is this happening to us? I didn't go to anybody with authority and say, what's going on here? I withdrew inside of me. And when I withdrew inside of me, I became a very revengeful child at that point in my life. And I was that way until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it intensified as I grew up in life. I was different than you, and you weren't going to hurt me. And that's the way I lived my life. Mom and Dad weren't improving their lot in life. They had all these kids. Another one was on the way by then. Yeah. Couldn't procure a good job. Couldn't raise our standard of living. And when people are in that kind of environment and they can't get ahead and they feel a little desperate and hopeless in that kind of situation, what do they do? What do we do? What did I do? They started drinking. When you start drinking and you feel that hopelessness and despair in your life and you see no way out, what do? You start picking on each other. You start fussing and you start fighting, you know. And sometimes it gets a little violent. And that violence filters down to the children. I know what it's like to be a small child and to be slapped across the face that you see stars. I know what it's like to be a small child, to be punched in the stomach and you fall to the ground and you gasp for air and you think you're going to die. I know what it's like to be called stupid and dumb by your own parents. I know what it's like to have your mother or your father say to you, you're going to get it when that other parent gets home, you're a little boy, you don't even know what you've done, and you sit there and you wait in fear till that other parent comes home. I know what it's like to be an abused child. I was an abused child. My mother and father couldn't do anything about that. The only thing they could do about that is the only thing they thought they could do about that. They would move. They would take a geographical cure. You know what that is. That's where we take ourselves and do the same stuff over again. So we moved from the small town in Denver, Colorado. We moved to a big city called, a small town of Trinidad, moved to the big city of Denver, Colorado. Now, I don't know if I said it, but I sure must have thought it. My life's going to change now. And we moved from this little small town of Trinidad into the big city of Denver, Colorado, and my life changed. It got worse. I'm going to tell you why it got worse. We moved from this small town into the big city into a place called the Projects. And if you don't know what the Projects is, that's where the poor people live. We were so poor, we had to elevate our station of life to move to where the poor people were. And when we moved to the Projects, the reason it got worse, because those people were in the same environment and situation that we were in, and there were more of us. Not only were there whites there and Mexicans there, now there were blacks there. And we hurt people, folks. We hurt people in order for us to feel good about our own station in life. It's a vicious cycle. And that's what we started doing. And Mom and Dad got worse. They started doing more things. They got more violent. We suffered more as a result of that. The consequences got too great. They did the most wonderful thing that they could do for each other at that point in their life. They got a divorce. And my dad moved all the way across the United States to that part of the northwest of the United States called a place called Seattle, Washington, and that's where I grew up. For a few months after he got divorced, he sent for me. Now, I don't know if I said it, but I must have thought it. My life's going to change now. When I got to Seattle, Washington, guess what? My life did change. It got better. And this is why it got better. My dad lived in a Norwegian neighborhood, worked out on a fishing boat. And those little Norwegian kids had never experienced a little Mexican kid before, so I was different, but I was different in a different kind of way. And things went well for a while. And then they started to revert back to the old ways. See, I was allowed to play with the little boys, but I wasn't allowed to play with the little girls. See, I was allowed to be your friend and go to school with you, but I wasn't allowed to date your sister. I was allowed to have a girlfriend, I was allowed to go out on dates, but as soon as the parents found out about it, it came to an end. And I'm 16 years old, and I'm hating me for being me. And at the age of 16, I took my first drink of alcohol. I wasn't a stranger to alcohol, you heard me tell you what happens in our house when they drink. I just knew one thing about alcohol, that it made you different and made you feel different than you were. And I didn't like who I was, and I wanted to feel different. I drank for the effect from the very first time I took a drink. I didn't care if I'd be the most loving, enduring person on the face of this earth, or if I was the most obnoxious person on the face of this earth. That wasn't a thought in my mind. I drank to be free from me, because I knew that what alcohol would do to you. Let me tell you what happened the first time I took a drink of alcohol. First time I took a drink of alcohol at the age of 16, I made a fool of myself. Very first time I took a drink. First time I took a drink of alcohol, I got drunk. First time I took a drink of alcohol, I blacked out. Been a blackout drinker since the day I started drinking alcohol. And the first time I took a drink of alcohol, I abused it and I passed out. That's my experience. And when I came to the next morning, we alcoholics don't wake up. We come to. I came to. And I was sick and I was hungover and I'm wanting to die one more time for the way I'm feeling because of the use of alcohol in my life at that point in my life. I said these words, and if I said them once, I've said them 1,000 times. Let's see if you can remember the first time you said the same 3 little words that I said after the first drunk, first blackout, first come to, feeling sick and hungover and wanting to die. I said, I'll never drink again. And when I said those things, I meant them. I don't want to feel that way anymore. But in that brief period of oblivion, in that brief period of oblivion, the very first time I took a drink, I was free. And I was free from me. And it didn't make a difference if you called me a Mexican. It didn't make a difference if I was poor. Because I was free from me. And that was my journey into alcoholism, and I drank for the next 27 years. And I want to tell you something, folks. During 27 years of drinking, it was not being free. I've been arrested over 16 times, put in jail as a direct result of alcohol. That's not being free. I've been arrested in 7 states, 3 foreign countries as a direct result of alcohol. That's not being free. I've been fired from jobs. I've been shot at. I've been beat up. I've had numerous car wrecks. I've ruined more relationships than I can remember, been barred from more bars than I want to remember. That's not being free. That's a living hell. And I did that for 27 years. July 19th, 1985, took my last drink of alcohol. Didn't know that was going to be my last drink of alcohol, but on that day, I made a fool of myself. I got drunk, I blacked out, and I passed out. And when I came to, I was arrested. I was in jail one more time for driving while under the influence of alcohol. And I can't tell you how I felt when I came to that next morning because I didn't know. I just know I wanted to die. Till I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I identified in that book how I felt. I was in a pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralization state of mind. That wanted me to die. That's how I felt. I had the words to go with what I felt like. And I did what I always did. Call my wife. Every time I'm in jail, call my wife. And every time my wife would come and get me out of jail. I mean, it's a logical thing for us drunks to do. It's a logical thing for potential Al-Anon to do for her drunk. But this time it was different. See, each time my wife came before, she'd always come alone. She wasn't alone this time. I'm married 17 years by now, have 2 daughters. She brings my oldest daughter with her. Normally when my wife comes and she sees me, she starts to cry. Well, she wasn't crying this time. She bailed me out. I came out of the jailhouse, into the foyer of the jailhouse. My wife standing there with a bail bondsman, who she knows on a first-name basis, with our lawyer, who has all of our money, and my daughter. And they met me with cold, stone silence. Now, if you've ever been in that situation, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't been there, don't go there. Don't go there. And I walked up to my wife, said to her the same thing I said 27 years earlier at the age of 16. I'm 43 years old now. I said to my wife, look right now, I said, I'll never drink again. And my wife said to me, it doesn't make a difference if you ever drink again. It doesn't make a difference if you drink yourself to death. It doesn't make a difference if you live or die. We just want you out of our lives. And my wife and my daughter turned around and walked out of that jailhouse. And like a good alcoholic that I am, I lowered my head. And I shuffled out to them, just like a little puppy dog would do, feeling sorry for me. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic for a long time. My only problem is I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't do nothing about it. With every resolve and reserve in me, I tried to stop, and it couldn't stop. I did everything in the world you could possibly do to stop drinking, except stop drinking. So I got in the back seat, they got in the front seat, we drove home in that cold stone silence, and I tell you, it was death. I'd rather have been back in that jailhouse. I really would have. It was really horrible. They drove into the foyer of the driveway of my house. They got out immediately, and they went in the front door, and they closed it behind them, and I was left in the back seat all by myself, feeling sorry for myself. I'm an emotional drunk. I don't know about you. You know, I like country western music, a good booze bottle, and I tell you, I'm right there. You know? And I was right there in the back seat. No music was on, but by God, I was there. And I'm crying, and I'm feeling sorry for me, and by God, you know, and I finally got the nerve and the mustard up. I got out of the car. I went to the front door of my house, went through it, closed it, sat at the stoop of my stairs in my foyer, and cried some more, feeling sorry for me. And my wife's up in her bedroom. She wants nothing to do with me. My oldest daughter who came with her left the house. She wants nothing to do with me. I have another daughter who is my enabler, who loved me in spite of my alcoholism. She wasn't there to take care of me. See, every time my wife previously would threaten to throw me out, get a divorce, just didn't want me around, my little girl would beg for her daddy. She'd grab my leg and hold on to it and beg to her, mommy, no, mommy, no, mommy, no. Mom would always relent and I'd stay. She wasn't there to take care of me. If I was sick, my little girl would take care of me. If I was hungry, she'd make me something to eat. If I wanted to drink, she'd even go get it. My baby wasn't there to take care of me. I'm left by me, with me. I sit at the stairs and I'm feeling sorry for myself and I can't stand it. It's not about stopping drinking, getting help and doing something about me. It's about dying. That's my only solution. I want to kill me. Not that I hadn't thought about suicide before. I thought about it hundreds of times in my lifetime. But this time I'm going to do it. That's my solution, is to die. That would solve the problem. So I'm sitting there thinking how I'm going to kill me. Now, in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says there somewhere that we're above intelligent people. We're not stupid. We just do stupid things. And I consider myself to be a relatively intelligent guy. So in thinking of killing me, you know, I'm not going to shoot me. I'm not going to hang me. I'm not going to drown me. For God's sakes, there's got to be an easier, softer way. I'm going to asphyxiate me. That way I just fall asleep. I'm dying. I did. That was my thought. And I thought hard and long about it. So I went upstairs, you know, when you're going to kill yourself, and you know exactly how you got to tell somebody. So I went there and told my wife. She got to know that I'm going to die for her. Makes sense to me. Went upstairs, the door was closed, our bedroom went inside, opened it up, her back's to me, of course she's leaning with it, she don't want nothing to do with me. I tell my wife, I'm going to kill myself. She says, well, go kill yourself. I said, I'm going to do it now. She says, bye. I leave, I go out to the garage, I open the garage door up, I go through it, close the garage door, find a hose, put it in the tailpipe, put it in the back of the window, get in the car, start the car up, I'm going to sit there, I'm going to die. Well, we alcoholics are what? Above intelligent people. So my brilliant thought was, well, I'm not going to sit here to wait to die, you know, why don't I just leave and let the garage fill up with fumes, that way I can come in and die immediately. Makes sense to me. I get out of the car, leave the car running. Close the car door, go through the garage door, close it behind me, let that thing fill up. I go in the house, sit there for a long time. I know I was there a long time. I was smoking that night. I'm a smoker. And I'm a drinker. And I'm an emotional drunk. and I got the music going, and I'm sitting there, and when I make up my mind to do something, I'm going to do it, you know. We're headstrong. And I'm there a long time because the ashtray is overflowing. And I can't tell you how long it is, but I can tell you it's a very long time. And so I figured the fumes are there. I just go in there. I'm going to die immediately. I open the front door, go through it, close the door, go to the garage, open it up, go through, close the door, and there's fumes in there. I'm gasping for air. That could have killed me. I get in the car to sit down to die, and the car runs out of gas. Get out of the car. Go in the house, tell my wife, I just tried to kill myself. My wife says, then why aren't you dead? I said, I ran out of gas. She says, you never could do anything right. My car has a full tank. Take it down there and finish the job. Now, I don't think that's right, that she should do that to me. I go downstairs and I stay there for a while, you know, and sometime during the night I fell asleep. I was too exhausted to fall asleep. And I woke up the next morning, and let me tell you something, folks, I'd done something I'd never done before. I rolled over on my knees. And when I rolled over on my knees, I said three little words that I had said 1,000 times before, but this time they were to save my life. The three little words that I said were, God, help me. And I didn't know they were going to save my life that day, even though I've said them 1,000 times before. I learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here that deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God deep down inside of us. In the last analysis, that's where he may be found. And on my knees that morning, from deep inside of me, I asked God to help me. And God helped me. And he changed my life. And I want to tell you how he did that. Standing at the top of the stairs that morning was my wife, a woman who hated my guts, who didn't care if I lived or died or drank myself to death, who just wanted me out of her life, was standing at the top of those stairs. And she told her story not long ago that she doesn't know why she did what she did for me. I do. You see, that same God that resides deep down inside of me, that resides deep down inside of all of you, also reached eyes deep down inside my wife. And God guided her down those stairs. God had her kneel at my side. God placed her hand gently on my shoulders, and God put these words into her mouth. She said, Gabe, if you want some help with your alcoholism, I'm willing to help you. This is a woman who hated my guts. And I call that the grace of God. And the reason why I call that the grace of God, because at that point in our lives, we were both sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I said the magic word, would you please help me? And she said yes. She called the treatment center, told them my story. They said they wanted to talk to me. She gave me the phone. First thing that person said on the other end says, are you an alcoholic? My response was, what do you think? His response was, it's not important what we think, it's important what you think. Are you or are you not? And I said, I have a problem every once in a while. This program of Alcoholics Anonymous identifies alcoholism as cunning, baffling, and powerful. I just tried to kill myself. I'm begging for help, and I'm telling those people I have a problem just once in a while. Boy, can we minimize in a flat-ass second when somebody asks us to tell the truth. You know? He says, do you want some help with your problem that you have every once in a while? And I says, yeah, I'll do anything you ask me to do. I need some help. Please, please help me. I'll do anything you want me to do. I need some help. I'm begging the man at this point. He says, we have an inpatient treatment facility. It's a 28-day inpatient treatment facility. Are you willing to attend something like that? I says, yes, I am. He says, if you're willing to attend, then we're willing to help you. He said, we got a bed available right now. Can you come over? And I said, I can't come right now. You know, we alcoholics have an agenda. We've got to take care of important things before we make such a strong commitment as trying to get some help for our alcoholism. My wife heard me say, I don't think I can come right now. She didn't hear anything else other than what we talked about. She said, I don't think I can come right now. She heard that. It made very much sense to her. She grabbed the phone, hung it up, drug my sore ass to that treatment center. And I spent 28 days there. And I learned in that treatment center that I had a disease called alcoholism. And I found from that treatment center where I can go to find recovery from my disease. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. They brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one day after I went to treatment. They gave me a big book. They told me to take it to AA, and they told me to have those people in AA interpret it for me, give me some understanding and clarity of what's in that book. That book will change my life. They guaranteed me that. They ensured that. If I did what this program suggests I do, I'll get exactly what this program suggests I would get. And I didn't even know what it was that I wanted. But I got it today. I'll tell you what I got. I got exactly what this program suggested I would get. I got a God of my understanding, and God gives me the peace and serenity that I didn't even know that I wanted. I wanted the noise up here to stop, and I wanted a peaceful heart. That's what this program has given me. So they brought me to the rooms of AA, and they took me to my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first meeting they ever took me to was a meeting called the 12 and 12. I had no idea what the meeting was, 12 and 12 meeting was all about. I came to a treatment, from a treatment facility in a treatment van with a bunch of other treatment people. We went into that meeting with our counselor leading the way. You know how embarrassing that is? For a person who wants help, you know how embarrassing that is? For a person who wants you to know that he's a newcomer, doesn't even know what a newcomer is himself, you know how embarrassing that is? And we walked through that meeting room. We went right to the back in a big line with our counselor leading the way. Hell, they all knew. We walked in this room, and you had to walk down this corridor into the room, and the coffee was at the back of the room, and the room was set up in a horseshoe with an open front. And you had it set up just like this right here. We got our coffee, and we sat in the back. A little man by the name of Marvin, he's from Springfield, Ohio, and he still lives there. He's still in the program of AA today. We're good friends. We're chairing that meeting. And they did the reading like they do at every meeting that I've been to, just like they did tonight. Had no idea what that was all about. Then he held up the 12 and 12. He says, we're going to have a meeting on 12 and 12. We'll talk about the step. Don't remember the step. He said, when we're finished talking about the step, we're going to discuss it. He said, before we do that, let's go around and let's introduce ourselves. And I said, oh, no. I got to introduce myself as an alcoholic in a group setting. Never had done that before. But you know the alcoholic is above intelligent person. And I'm the 16th person back, I know, because I counted up. And I knew that I had to introduce myself as an alcoholic. First man got up, said his name was John. He was an alcoholic. Second person said her name was Mary, and she was an alcoholic. I knew exactly when I had to do it. And I had 16 names in front of me to practice my name. My name is Gabe Chavez. I'm an alcoholic. I'm up here. I don't know that's my problem. And I'm saying, my name is Gabe Chavez, I'm an alcoholic, my name is Gabe Chavez, I'm an alcoholic. And when it got to me, I said, my name was Dave and I had alcoholism. I done embarrassed myself. I done embarrassed myself. Went around the room, Marvin stood there, didn't say a thing. He said, we're going to read out of this book. This is the step we're going to read on. He says, you read a line, you read a page, you read a paragraph, you don't read it all, you pass it on. When we're done, we're going to discuss it. He says, John, you start. John did something I didn't want him to do. He reintroduced himself. I says, oh God. I got to do it again. Well, we alcoholics are above intelligent people. I'm still the 16th person back, and I figured out what my problem was. I didn't have enough time to practice. So while they're reading, and I'm not listening, and I'm in my head, and I'm practicing, and my name is Gabe Chavez, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Gabe Chavez, I'm an alcoholic. When it got to me, I said my name is Abe, and I was acrylic. Couldn't get it out. By then, little Marvin couldn't stand it. He stood up. He's a short guy, so everybody could see him. Pointed his finger right at me. He said, I don't know what your name is, don't know what your problem is, but you're definitely in the right place. Keep coming back. Been coming back ever since. Been coming back ever since. Now, I know this program works because I work it, and those people who are in that meeting work it. They're still here. There are people that still call me Abe, Dave, and Gabe. There's one guy comes to me and says, hey, how are you doing, acrylic? You know, they were there. They remember. They don't let you forget. They call us friends now. In any case, that was my experience in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My second meeting was a meeting just like this, where somebody shared their experience, strength, and hope. And I went to that meeting. And the first time I heard somebody tell on themselves, and I was amazed. But the man was sharing his story, and he was sharing a part of his story that had a profound effect on me. And I didn't know it was going to have a profound effect on me, because he just told one story that I heard and remembered. The story was about unconditional love. Now, I heard the word love. Now, if you're anything like an alcoholic like me, you want love, but you can't receive love, you can't give love, but you're wanting all these people to love you. And that was me. And you were doing that, and I didn't recognize it. You were loving me until I learned to love myself. You were loving me unconditionally. You didn't put no conditions on me. You told me to keep coming back. And I didn't understand that. But this man told the story of unconditional love, and I'm going to tell it to you, and it's the story of unconditional love. We pass it on. That's what we do in the rooms of AA. It had a profound effect on me. I hope it has a profound effect on you. It's about a story of an old-timer in AA and a newcomer in AA going out on a 12-step call to help some alcoholic achieve sobriety. That's what this program's about. So the old-timer and the newcomer were driving down the street, and they see a pathetic drunk laying in the street. So the old-timer stops the car, gets out of the car, walks over to the pathetic drunk laying in the street, bends down, picks him up, holds him in his arms. Now the newcomer observes the old-timer holding the pathetic drunk in his arms, and he sits there for a while, and then he finally gets out of the car, and he walks over to the old-timer holding the pathetic drunk in his arms, and says, "What are we going to do with that drunk?" And the old-timer says, "Well, we're going to love him." And the newcomer says, "Well, geez, how long do we have to love him?" And the old-timer says, "We're going to love him until he learns to love himself. Give him unconditional love. Not for what he wanted to be, wished to be, or hoped to be, but simply for what he was. Human being, child of God, alcoholic, nothing more, nothing less." And that's what you were given to me. You were given to me the greatest gift another human being could give another human being, unconditional love. You put no conditions on that. When you love somebody, to tell them that you love them is not a true affection of love. It's a program of action. If you love somebody, you must show them. You put no conditions on it. You love all of them. You love the good in them and you love the bad in them. And that's the way you love me into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How do I show that I love you? I show up when you ask me to show up. I stand up every time that I talk in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, discussion or otherwise. I will stand up, not to show off, to be the center of attention, to show respect for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and those in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I show you that I love you. I will hug you anytime you allow me to hug you. I'll help you as much as I humanly can help you if it's possible for me to help you. I will listen to you and I will respond to you without trying to offend you. Just like you did with me. That's what I do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the message I try to share with you. That's the message that those little Olympians did at the Special Olympics. Love somebody beyond their own capacity to be the winner in the fellowship of their fellowship. That's what this program's all about. And when I heard that, I knew that I was an unloving person. And I did unloving things. And I don't want to live that way anymore. And the process of me turning out to be the decent, I believe, human being I am today, to the degree that I can be, is a process of recovery one day at a time. We're not perfect. But you know, that's not a bad ideal to try to strive towards, to be the best that you can be. And that's what this program has given me, the tools in order to do just that. By identifying myself, what sets me free and allows me to discover that I play a part in everything that I've ever done in life. And that's my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. After I got out of that treatment center, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous so much. My wife just thought if I quit drinking, everything would be okay. But I didn't substitute drinking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I substituted dying for trying to live. My wife told me one time that my children were so upset, they said, "What do they have to do, Mom? Do we have to become drunks in order for Dad to pay attention to us?" Because I was gone so much. But as a result of me gone so much and learning so much and doing what this program suggests I do to the best of my ability outside of the rooms where I learned it and practicing in all my affairs, those children have come back to me. And those children love me today. You know, how come I know they love me today? Because they tell me, and they show me. They named their kids after me, for goodness sakes. Of course, I paid a pretty for that, you know, on their weddings. It was very expensive to have those kids named after me. But they love me. Those children have never seen me drunk. Never seen me drunk. They've seen me be part of a human race, though. I tell you, that wasn't the pretty sight, I tell you. Anyway, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of what? Of helping other people the way that you have helped me. When I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't seen my dad for 5 years. The last time I'd seen my dad, I'd made a fool of myself, I got drunk, I blacked out, I passed out, and I ran. And I came here. And I got married. And I did some things in between. And all the time that I was gone, my father tried to make contact with me, call me on special occasions, write me letters, send me cards, whatever. And I denied all that. Then I come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. 3 years in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, blaming my dad for me. Not appreciating anything he'd ever done for me, but blaming him for me. Denying my dad any access to our family whatsoever. 3 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, 8 years since I've seen my dad. You told me to go home and love my dad. That's the message I heard. It was Father's Day, for goodness sakes. Go home and love your dad. He did the best he could do. What's your problem? Well, the problem sent in my mind, I had to restructure that and think, well, maybe if I did something, something else will happen. So I went home and called my dad. 8 years. Called my dad. Paul was in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Called out the son he knew, the son I'm becoming that he wanted, that he had to discover that for himself. Believe it or not. Told my dad to come visit me in Dayton, Ohio. Get to know the daughter I doesn't know. Get to know the grandchildren he doesn't know. Get to meet the son that he has not ever known. And my dad told me, said he'd come at the first opportunity he could. The very next day, he flew from Seattle, Washington, to Dayton, Ohio. Spent 2 marvelous weeks with us. And every day that he was here, he went to an AA meeting with me, or he went to an Al-Anon meeting with my wife, or both of us. Got to know my wife, got to love her, got to know my children, got to love them, got to know his son, who's in AA in recovery. And while my dad was here, I got to put the program of practical action into action. I got to go to my dad and make my amends up close and personal for the direct problems I had caused. It's hard enough to go to somebody with your hat in your hand and say you're sorry. I've been sorry all my life. But to know the exact nature of your wrong, if you don't do that, you're not making an amend at all. That's worse than making an amend. And I went to my dad with the exact nature of my wrong, and I told my dad that I'm sorry for keeping him at arm's length all these years. And I said, what can I do to make that right, Dad? And my dad said to me, he says, you're doing it. You're in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. It seems like your life is changing, and as a result of that, I get to love my son again. You're doing it. Keep doing that. And after 2 weeks, he took me back to the airport. I took him back to the airport weather, and we're sitting there. We're both very emotional people at this time. We're hugging each other. We're both crying. My dad said to me the most important thing that I ever heard in my life, that any important, it's the most important thing that any child would like to hear from their mother or father. My father said to me, son, there isn't a father on the face of this earth that isn't more proud of you than I am. And I want to thank you for that. Because if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, there wouldn't be me. And if there wouldn't be me and you, there'd be no father. There'd be no mother. There'd be no wife. There'd be no children. There'd be no job. There'd be no friends. There'd be no nothing. As a result of doing one simple thing, not drinking, as a result of simply reaching out my hand to you and asking for help, I got all this stuff. I got to come here and tell you about it. That's wonderful stuff, folks. And you know how we are about our stuff. The stuff inside of us will kill us, you know. I want to tell you a couple of stories. I love to tell stories, you know. The reason why I like to tell stories is because stories say in such words much better than I can, make a point much better than I can. But as a result of that, I get to identify with that. Hope you get to identify with that, too. I want to tell you a story of love. Because I think that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's about love. You know, when I went out looking for unconditional love, didn't know what I was receiving. You know what I found? I found unconditional love. Did I find it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? No, I found the courage and the faith and the ability to go out and find it. Ever since I was a small boy, I've been reading Reader's Digest. And the reason why I was reading Reader's Digest is because we were poor and it was given to us. And in Reader's Digest, they always have inspirational stories, stories of heroes. And I hated me so much growing up that I read those stories and I lived vicariously through those stories. I wanted to be a hero. I wanted to be something other than what I was. 8 months in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, searching for unconditional love. I'm sitting at home in my favorite chair reading my favorite magazine, and I come to a part in Reader's Digest where the title of the story is called Unconditional Love. And that catches my eye because that's what I'm looking for. And when I read the first line of that story, I connected with it, and I knew exactly what that story was all about already because, you see, I lived it. This is what it said. I knew I was different from the other children just by the way the other children treated me. True story of a little girl who was born with a cleft palate. She had a crooked nose, misshapen lip, uneven teeth, garbled speech. And when the other children would ask the little girl what happened to her lip, she'd tell them that she fell on a piece of glass and cut it. She'd rather lie to them than tell them the truth that she was born different. Totally convinced that no one outside of her immediate family loved or cared for her, and she wanted everybody to love her. And then she met a teacher by the name of Mrs. Leonard in the second grade, and all the children adored Mrs. Leonard, but no one was going to come to adore or love that teacher more than this little girl, and for a very special reason. Mrs. Leonard every year would give a test to her children in her class to test their hearing capability. The test consisted of a child getting up from their desk, walking over to the corner of the teacher's desk, pointing an ear towards the wall, and plugging that ear, an ear towards the teacher. The teacher would whisper something to the child would repeat it, and this is how she tested their hearing capability. That little girl knew she had to take that test, and while she was sitting at her desk, she decided she was going to cheat, for you see, she also had a bad ear, and didn't want to have one more thing signaled about her, still made her different than she already was. Well, her turn came last, as it usually did. She got up from her desk, walked slowly over the corner of the teacher's desk. She pointed her good ear towards the wall and pretended to cover it. She didn't want to miss what Miss Leonard had to whisper to her, and her bad ear towards the teacher. And she knew from the test that Miss Leonard would ask things like, is the sky blue, is the grass green, or is she red? And she wondered, what would Miss Leonard whisper to me? And then Mrs. Leonard whispered 7 simple words into this little girl's ear that changed this little girl's life forever. For what she whispered surely got put there. She whispered ever so softly, I wished you were my little girl. That teacher gave that little girl unconditional love, not for what she wanted to be, hoped to be, or wished to be, simply for what she was. A little girl, a human being, a child of God, nothing more, nothing less. There's one thing that I've learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that a child learns to be loved by being loved. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to love a child of God. That's you. That's me. That's my wife, and that's my children, and that's my grandchildren. This program has given me the greatest gift that a man and a woman can ever receive in their life. And we want to squander that away because we think we deserve more than what was so freely given to us because we're so smart and so intelligent. What we are is children of God, doing God's work. God wants us to be joyous, happy, and free. Ask yourself a more serious question. Is that what you want to be? What God wants you to be? Or do you want to be what you think you should be in order to get what you think you should have? And I'll kindly remind you that thinking is our problem. We can't go to our sick heads and come up with a healthy answer. We don't have the power. The power lies outside of us, a power greater than us. The book says, may you find him now. I was a very angry man when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know that. You probably don't believe that. I'm a nice guy. When I came here, I was an angry guy. And right after finding God, it says this in the third step, that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. You ever heard that? Now, don't you want to be successful? I want to be successful. You know how to be successful? The book of Alcoholics Anonymous gives you the guide and gives you the direct answer to how to become successful. Page 111 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. First line, it says this. The first principle of success. Hey, I want to be successful. There's a principle of success. The first principle of success is that one should never be angry. Well, if you've been angry all your life and you know how not to be angry, how are you going to do that? Well, you turn the page. Page 112. First three words will change your life forever. You know what it says? Read this book. The book has the answers. Why do they wait to 112 before they tell you to read the book? That's the answer. You see, in the rooms of AA, the people will share their experience, strength, and hope, and they'll tell you what's in that book, and they'll tell you to read it. We ain't going to listen to everybody in the rooms of AA. They don't know as much as we do anyway. The answers they tell us are in the book, so I have to wait till I get to 112 to discover that that's going to change my life. Well, let me tell you something, folks. If you just stay in the rooms of AA long enough to get to page 112, you're well on your way to recovery. And you understand precisely what that book's all about. It says, if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic and wants to get over it, what do I got to do? The first question is, you know what it says after that? The purpose of the book, that's what it says, the purpose of the book is to answer your questions specifically. Well, my first question is, well, what's my problem? You know what the book says? The main problem of the alcoholic is centered in his mind. He's telling you what your problem is. Well, if it's centered in my mind, what am I going to recover from? Well, it tells you that we alcoholics recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Key word, seemingly. We're not crazy, it just seems that way. And that's what we recover from. And it says, that is the main purpose of the book. There's a purpose of the book and there's a main purpose. To show you precisely how we recovered. From what? From a seemingly hopeless state of mind. Because my main problem lies here. Well, what I gotta do? You gotta find the power. That power which is God, may you find him now. It's all in the book. You have a precise way, you have a specific way, and you have an exact way to recover if you live out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do that. That's why I need you to guide me to do the things that I think I'm smart enough to do, but I can't. God will do for you what you can't do for yourself, but he'll never do for you what you can do for yourself. And he gives you the ability to stay sober one term time, and he gives me you, and you help me find him a greater understanding to do what God won't do for me as to what? Become the best person I can be. It is so simple, folks. You know what? I figured it all out in 15 years. That's all it took me. 15 years. It ain't hard to get 15 years sobriety. It's a bitch living one day at a time, though. That's why we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. AA will change your life. Now, I know it's getting late, and I'm just rambling on, and I want to close. I really do. I appreciate you asking me here. I hope I've given you some hope in your recovery of alcoholism. But I want to close with one last story. I want to tell you about a little boy. A little boy who was raised on this farm. Had never been anywhere, never seen anything, never experienced anything in his life except what was on that farm. One day a man came by. He was an advanced man for the circus. He had all these posters under his arm. And the little boy saw the pictures on the posters. There were pictures of beautiful people in beautiful costumes, and there were beautiful animals on those posters. And that little boy never saw anything like that in his entire life. And the advanced man for the circus went over to the little boy's grandfather and says, can we hang one of these posters out on the barn by the roadside so we can advertise the circus coming to town? And the grandfather said, sure. And the little boy kept looking at the posters of the beautiful people and their beautiful costumes and all those beautiful animals, and he wanted to go see the circus when the circus came to town. They went to his grandfather and said, Grandpa, when the circus comes to town, can I go see the circus? And the grandfather says, sure, son. You work hard this week, and I'll give you the money, and you go see the circus when the circus comes to town. And the little boy did. He worked real hard. He worked harder than he's ever worked in his entire life. And the night before the circus came to town, he went to his grandfather. He said, Grandpa, I worked hard. Will you give me the money so I can go see the circus tomorrow? Grandfather, being a good grandfather, said, sure, son. And he reached in his pocket and he pulled out a shiny 50-cent piece to give that little boy to go see the circus the next day. The little boy was all excited, could hardly sleep, got up real early. He got dressed, and he marched 5 miles to town to go see the circus. When he got to town, he could see into town. He could see on one side of town they were unloading the circus train, and they were forming a parade, and they were going to march through the town to advertise the circus, to the other side of town where they erected the big top, and they were going to put on the circus. And the little boy marched to the middle of town, set the stoop at the curb, and he watched that parade pass him by. And there they were, all those people, in their beautiful costumes, and all those beautiful animals. He had never seen anything like that in his entire life, and there they were, right in front of him. And as the last man in the parade came by was a clown, he saw that little boy sitting at the stoop at the curb. And when he passed that little boy by, he tipped his hat to that little boy. And with that, the little boy took that shiny 50-cent piece, and he flipped it in the clown's cap, and he got off the stoop at the curb, and he marched 5 miles back to his farm. And his grandfather was waiting on him. He could see him.